It's Friday, February 1st, and the call was going outside the house. We start here. It was called a potential smoking gun. Now, in an ABC News exclusive, they're not related. Sources back up a key part of Donald Trump Jr.'s story. President Trump tells negotiators, don't bother.
If there's no wall, it doesn't work.
How his battle of words with Democrats and his own intelligence chiefs could affect the real world. And police called it a horrible accident.
These officers were playing Russian roulette.
But a prosecutor's asking, should these cops be believed? From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When you talk about potential collusion between President Trump's campaign and the Russian government, there is one day that seems like it could hold a lot of answers.
That now infamous Trump Tower meeting with Paul Manafort, Jared Kushner, and the Russians.
That day was June 9th, 2016. It's really just about 20 minutes, half an hour that we're really talking about. Around 4 in the afternoon, a Russian lawyer walked through the door of Trump Tower. Her name was Natalia Veselnitskaya. You've heard about this, right? She sits down with Donald Trump Jr., with campaign chair Paul Manafort, and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and she starts pitching them on changing sanctions policy toward Russia. This is not what Donald Trump Jr. had been promised. Another guy with Veselnitskaya, Rob Goldstone, had sold this meeting as a chance to provide official documents that would incriminate Hillary Clinton.
Don Jr.'s response, if it's what you say, I love it.
During that meeting, he asked Veselnitskaya, what about the Hillary stuff? Where's the Hillary stuff? According to everyone involved, she didn't really have much on Hillary Clinton. Everyone left a bit peeved.
In retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently. For me, this was opposition research.
And everyone's always asked Donald Jr., your dad didn't know about this, really?
My son is a wonderful young man. Most people would have taken that meeting.
The man who ripped Hillary Clinton whenever he could on the campaign trail.
She doesn't have the look, she doesn't have the stamina.
The man who reportedly was so involved in campaign minutiae, he would give lighting notes after his interviews. This guy would not be told about a potential document dump from a Russian. And congressional investigators said that truth might hinge on a couple quick phone calls. Phone calls from Donald Trump Jr. to someone in the days, even the hours, leading up to that meeting. Overnight, sources shared some key information about those phone calls, and they could have huge implications for anyone trying to keep track of whether that meeting was part of a larger plot. ABC's John Santucci and Matthew Mosk broke key details here. They're on our investigative team. And so, guys, explain what calls we're talking about here.
So the big thing here, Brad, is that these are three blocked phone calls that congressional investigators and others have been trying to figure out who they were because of the timing. So two of these phone calls came on June 6th, before that infamous Trump Tower meeting, and then a third phone call happened on June 9th, which was the day of the meeting. And always we've been wondering and asking sources, and there's been questions both from federal prosecutors and from congressional investigators, who Donald Trump Jr. was speaking to. Of course, the big assumption on many people's part is that maybe this was the president, because we know around that time they were trying to gain information, of course, about Hillary Clinton and others as he was moving further and further along in the campaign. And that was always one of the many guesses, that perhaps it was a conversation about that meeting, what they learned from that meeting, that Donald Trump Jr. relayed to his father.
And there's a big difference between this happening on the president's watch and the president himself being complicit in a Russian lawyer coming over to help out.
That's exactly right. And I think one thing we heard, especially from investigators on the House side, was a strong desire to subpoena phone records.
I guarantee you there were phone calls in addition to those emails, and I want to hear all of it.
The Republicans were in charge, so they couldn't answer this big question: who did Don Jr. speak to before and after this pivotal meeting?
Okay, so what did you learn last night?
So we've been working on this for quite some time, and our sources finally learned within the last couple of weeks that Senate investigators learned the identity of these calls and whom they were with. So we know that out of the three calls, they were with two individuals. So someone had two calls. One of the rounds was with Brian Franz.
Any of his children, you'd be proud to have them as part of your family. That's how I judge a winner, how somebody manages their family, raises their family.
CEO of NASCAR, longtime Trump family friend, came out and endorsed President Trump during the campaign. The other person that the calls were with were Howard Lorber, a big-time real estate developer in New York.
People have always asked me, does Donald listen to you? And I always say, yes, he listens. That doesn't mean he'll do what you say, but he's a thoughtful listener.
Well, they're not President Trump.
No, they're not. They're not related. Remember around that time, you know, Donald Trump Jr. was out in the campaign trail for his father, was helping to run surrogate operations and fundraising.
As I've gone around the country, I've seen people, hardworking Americans, men and women who built this country.
And both of these individuals did exactly that.
Really, it pops the balloon on the whole idea that these calls hold significance to the investigation.
Well, so for months you had lawmakers say, you know, who were these phone calls to? And for months, Donald Trump Jr. told Congress, I don't remember. So does this just fundamentally alter how we think about the president's campaign and potentially colluding with Russians?
Not really. I think what this does just is take the question of these block calls, which have been held out as potentially super important, and really takes them off the table. It doesn't actually prove anything one way or the other in terms of whether Donald Trump Jr. spoke with his father about the Trump Tower meeting or not. They could have spoken in person. They could have spoken in other calls. It just means that these block calls that there was so much suspicion about weren't what a lot of the Democrats thought they were.
And Brad, let's not forget here, the meeting still happened. They still sought a meeting to seek dirt on Hillary Clinton with a Russian lawyer who allegedly promised that.
And now Democrat Adam Schiff, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, he says he still wants to investigate for himself whether Donald Trump Jr. ever talked about this meeting with his father. Great reporting, guys. Thank you.
Thanks, Thank you. Brad.
Yesterday, we told you about this week's meetings between congressional Republicans and Democrats over border protection measures. And there's one word, of course, that could make all the difference.
A wall.
And if you ask the lawmakers in the room, we've been told, they're not as far apart as you might think. One of them goes, you know, let's fix the fencing in Southern California. The other one goes, okay, that sounds good. We just need judges to judge some asylum cases. So you could imagine a world where, left to their own devices, these lawmakers could come out and say, we've reached an agreement on border protection. But they're not in this alone. Hovering over all this are President Trump and Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And yesterday, the president came right out and said, this is not going to work. ABC's chief White House correspondent Jonathan Carl's with us now. And so, Jonathan, we're 2 weeks from the government running out of money again. Was yesterday the day a border deal died?
If we're going to declare it dead after one day, you know, it's really quite a statement. But the president kind of did that.
I'm not waiting for this committee. And I've told a lot of people, I don't expect much coming out of the committee.
He said because he doesn't think there will be a deal because of the way the Democrats are acting and what he's hearing.
So if there's no wall, it doesn't work.
And as if on cue, Nancy Pelosi came out and made it clear that her position on the wall has not changed.
There's not going to be any wall money in the legislation.
So it looks pretty grim. Now, Brad, that leaves, a lot of people say, two choices. The president gets his deal with his border wall, or he declares a national emergency. Now, let me say to you that I think there's a third possibility out there, and that the president doesn't get any new money for his border wall, but still manages to declare victory. Listen to this. There is money in the pipeline now for 10 miles of brand spanking new wall where there was no fencing that begins construction in February. Now, 10 miles is a far cry from 2,000 miles, but 10 miles, you could have a heck of a photo op if you were President Trump in front of 10 miles of wall, couldn't you? I it wouldn't surprise me if he ultimately declares victory even without effectively getting any more money for new border walls.
And Martha, yesterday the Pentagon said that at the president's direction they're sending several thousand more troops to the border, but that intelligence assessment doesn't even cite a security threat at the border.
Well, and if we're talking about national emergencies, how damaging was it that the president's chiefs of intelligence came out this week? They listed all these threats the U.S. is facing. We've talked about them already. But then that the southern border did not even really crack that list. I mean, where does he stand with his intelligence community right now?
That was an extraordinary moment. You know, the report itself and the testimony before Congress, and you know, now the president, yesterday he summoned his intelligence chiefs to the Oval Office for a meeting. After that meeting, he spoke to reporters and he said, they say that they were, you know, wildly misquoted.
It was taken out of context. So what I do is I'd suggest that you call them. They said it was fake news. So, which frankly didn't surprise me.
I mean, as you know, we were watching the testimony on live television before a congressional committee. This is not you know, it's not a matter of being misquoted, but I do think that there is a point, which is that there are subtleties in intelligence, and these are not political figures, and intel analysts don't speak the way people who host morning podcasts speak. You know, there are gradations here. You know,
would that they did. We get some straight answers around here. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, imagine your community had a problem with sex assault. Now imagine it was actually 50% worse than you thought. That's what just happened at our nation's military academies. In the last few years, military chiefs have repeatedly been forced to sit in front of senators and explain why so many cadets at military academies say they've been sexually assaulted.
I am humbled to be sitting here today before you as the first male survivor to testify in front of Congress on this very important issue. And
as a direct result, those academies have had to come up with new protocols, new procedures. And a lot of service members say, you know, thank goodness they addressed this problem. But now we're learning more cadets, more midshipmen say they were abused in 2018 than they were the year before. A lot more of them. ABC's Louis Martinez is at the Pentagon right now. Louis, you read this report. I mean, how big is this spike?
Brad, it's a big spike. It's 50% over the previous survey that was conducted about 2 years ago. This is a survey that's carried out at all three military service academies. The idea is for Pentagon officials to get a sense of what's going on in terms of the prevalence of sexual assault at the military academies, and that's what they're measuring here. They came up with 747 respondents saying they had experienced some type of unwanted sexual contact. That definition involves groping all the way to rape. That was 50% more than the 500 that were experienced just 2 years ago.
Wow, but 50%, like that's just not a significant rise. Like, I don't care whatever police precinct you're in the country, like that's a huge spike.
No, you're right, Brad. It's a really significant jump, and officials know it. And one of the things that they're really concerned about is the fact that the number of actual reports that were filed with authorities internally with Pentagon officials remained pretty much the same. There were only five more than last year, up at 117. So that's what they're really concerned about.
People are saying in an anonymous survey, I was sexually assaulted, but they're not actually telling their superiors at that same rate.
That's exactly right. They feel more comfortable because it is an anonymous survey to step forward and say they've experienced some type of either groping or some kind of sexual assault or maybe even a rape. But when it comes to accountability, they're not stepping forward in the large numbers that would be anticipated. That number is remaining stagnant.
Well, so what are the issues that experts say, you know, lead to this? If the fixes so far aren't working, what do you do?
Well, what military leaders know that there are certain issues that need to be dealt with. And last year, what they tried to do was put in place some new systems. Now, these weren't captured by the report because the new systems were put in place just before that survey was carried out. But one of the things they're looking at is the tie-in between alcohol abuse among both victims and predators. And there's another approach that they want to take. They realize that in the past, they may have had an impact when it was done from the top down. Now they want to emphasize that leadership comes from within as well, that it's the near peers, the classmates who can do something about sexual assault. If they see something, they can step forward and prevent it. Or if something has happened, they can also step forward and say that something has happened so that the numbers can be reduced down within among their classmates.
And just in the last year, of course, we've seen this new willingness from sexual assault survivors to speak up, if even in a survey, but just some devastating numbers there. Louis, thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
There is news tonight about the police officer charged with manslaughter for killing a fellow officer in St. Louis. Investigators said they were playing a version of Russian roulette in his home.
At some point this week, you might have heard about the so-called Russian roulette shooting in St. Louis. It's bizarre. It's super sad. A cop was killed by her colleague. She was off duty at the time. The shooter and his partner were supposed to be on duty. And in recent days, this has taken a turn. Suddenly, it's not just a story about a tragic accident. It's now a story about how a police department investigates a crime when one of your own is the shooter, one of your own is dead, and what do you owe to each of them? ABC's Lindsay Davis has been following this. And so, Lindsay, walk me through this initial crime scene. What are we looking at?
Allegedly, what we're told is that these officers were playing Russian roulette and that Nathaniel Hendren and Caitlin Alex were going back and forth with a gun that had at least one bullet in the chamber and pointing it at each other's chests. And so it's late at night. It's after midnight. Nathaniel Hendren is supposed to be on duty out on patrol, but instead he's at home. And Alex is over at his house. And he and his partner then end up calling 911, and they take her to the hospital, and she's pronounced dead just minutes later.
Okay, two things here. A, I'm not a Russian roulette expert. I always thought that was the game where you aimed the gun at yourself. But B, and more importantly, this kind of evolved as the investigation went on, right? So what happened here?
The St. Louis Police Department has really come under fire because preliminarily they were saying, look, this was all just a tragic accident.
This young woman's life was cut short, unfortunately, and we have to address what happened on that night.
And that was before they really had a chance to collect some of the primary evidence. But since then, Nathaniel Hendren, who's 29 years old, he's been charged with involuntary manslaughter.
As much as it saddens me and my staff to file these charges, Caitlin and her family deserve accountability and justice.
He's now out on bail. But also, according to court documents that we were able to obtain, it said that he also had consumed alcoholic beverages while on duty. So the question that the prosecutor raised in a blistering letter to the police chief was, look, why were there only urine and breath tests taken from the officers who were on the scene and no blood tests?
On the night of this tragic incident, our force investigative unit and our internal affairs division follows city regulations and department procedures to the letter.
So she's kind of saying, look, you guys have been obstructionists. And he's saying that's absolutely not the case at all.
Yeah, the police chief is saying we are doing this investigation by the book. But that's the thing, right? It's easy to forget how much discretion police have in how they investigate something until you've got people going like, why didn't you do this? And by then it's often too late.
By not having those officers take a blood test, in a way, you can understand why the prosecutor is suggesting that they are obstructing justice.
She loved her job. Even on her days off, she would go visit all her friends down there.
And what has been lost in all of this is the victim herself. You know, 24-year-old police officer who was just married 3 months ago. And now her parents have actually obtained legal counsel because they are trying to figure out what happened.
The way and everything, how it went down, I don't like it. I think there's more answers. We need more answers.
Because it really just seems so unclear about how she's over at the officer's house. They're supposed to be out on patrol, but they're not. And then this bizarre game ends up in her death.
Yeah, it gets deeper with this prosecutor, too. She reportedly had clashes with this department before. Last year, she reportedly listed 28 officers who she says are not credible as primary witnesses in crimes. Lindsay, thanks for being here.
All right, thanks, Brad.
And one last thing. We've seen temperatures plummet in 32 states this week.
Chicago is forecasting a wind chill of 50 below zero Thursday. That means frostbite on exposed skin can begin in as little as 5 minutes.
So it's easy to forget that in Alaska, it's way warmer than usual. And that's freaking out Jennifer Hawks. Where are you right now?
I am in Willow, Alaska.
She says her home is semi-remote. When I asked her what that means, she says she can stand in her driveway and scream and no one will hear or help her.
I have half a moose out in my yard right now hanging from the meatpole from the roadkill program. It was a bull moose and was killed by a car.
Wait, that's really a thing? Like you've got a dead moose in your yard?
It's really a thing.
And when she's not dealing with that, she actually runs dog sled races, including the first big race of the year, the Kinnick 200.
A lot of mushers depend on our race to qualify, not just for Iditarod, but for the Yukon Quest.
But this year, she says, they've been having heat wave after heat wave. Now, in Alaska, that means 35 degrees. But still, this race is supposed to go across frozen lakes.
And you also need to make sure that the thickness of the ice on the lakes is sufficient for all the teams.
As race day approached, they pushed the date back. This week, they decided to cancel altogether.
First, we postponed to February 9th, and then we realized it was already open water, as we call it.
And Jennifer's actually had to deal with stuff like this for several years now. She's not the only one. The Iditarod used to start in the streets of Fairbanks, Alaska, downtown. Now there's rarely enough snow on the ground for even a ceremonial start.
They truck it in. They truck it in because, again, like, you know, it used to be they didn't have to do that. So then,
Jennifer, is the dog sled world worried about how climate change is affecting their sport?
I don't think anyone wants to go there yet.
She says everyone's making adjustments where they can. Her race course next year might not even go over water at all. People mush on ATVs until snow comes, but ATV season seems to go later and later.
So I don't think people really want to look at what is the future of sled dog mushing in Alaska? Because it's not only a lot of mushers' livelihoods, it's their passion. It's like Super Bowl and the World Series rolled into one for these people. That's, they live and they breathe it.
In the meantime, Jennifer's seeing changes in her own backyard.
Yeah, normally when Alaska is acting like Alaska, I usually just hang the meat from my meat pole in my side yard all winter long.
Now she says it's not cold enough for that moose to keep. She's giving away steaks all weekend if you're interested. And Jennifer actually directed a documentary on mushing called Everything It Takes. And she sent us a picture of that moose in her yard right now. If you can handle that, you can follow us on Twitter, on Instagram at StartHereABC. Start Here is produced by David Rind, Josh Cohan, Tara Gimbel, Kelly Therese, Laszlo Toth, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Abe Velez, Jason Potts, Maria Kim, Elizabeth Russo, and Jeff Fitzgerald. Special thanks this week to Ian Pannell, his team in Venezuela, everyone at our foreign desk for bringing you that story. Also to our partners at Amplify Media. Our executive producers are Steve Jones and Andrew Kalb. I'm Brad Milkey. See you Monday.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.